Podcast listeners, Al Martin here. This is part two with Robert Plotkin, who is the author of The Genie and the Machine, and he's a founding partner with Blue Shift IP. Look, if you didn't listen to part one, I'd highly encourage it. We talk about what patents are. He gives advice for law students. He talks about top priorities. He talked about it being the wild, wild west as it relates to AI these days, and a lot of the companies are choosing to grow faster than the damage they may create. It goes on and on. I'd highly encourage you to listen to it. So thanks. I appreciate you listening. Bye. Let's
go. You're listening to Making Data Simple, where we make the world of data effortless, relevant, and yes, even fun.
So you can patent an algorithm, right?
Yeah.
As part of a large language model. But here's my question on that. Where is the line of distinction between a patentable algorithm versus business as usual, just like normal programming practices? Because a lot of these models that are built on transformers that end up creating a neural network, I mean, a lot of that's business as usual now, or could be. I mean, somebody came up with the first. Actually, it was Google that I think came up with the transformer first. But now that it's out, what can you patent and what can you not?
So, you know, in the context of software patents, this question you asked of where is the line, the law and the patent office have never been able to define that really clearly. It differs from country to country a lot. And here's one reason why it's never been able to be defined very clearly is that, I mentioned earlier that traditionally industrial processes, like the process for smelting iron ore back in the day, right? If you came up with a new way of doing that, you could patent that process. And there wasn't really much debate about whether that could be patented. Why? It was easy to define. You could see it. You could touch it. You could describe it easily and in clearly defined terms. But when it comes to patenting a process that's carried out in software, you know, the words you might use are often more mathematical or abstract in nature. If you write a patent that describes what's in code, you know, you're going to be using terms that relate to performing operations on data, sometimes mathematical operations on abstract data structures. And there's always been a prohibition on patenting certain types of abstract things like laws of nature, okay? Even if a human discovers them, you can't, even if you were the first person now to discover F equals MA or E equals MC squared, right? You'd call that a law of nature written in a mathematical form. The patent law would say, we don't care how much of a genius you had to be to discover that law of nature. It's just out of the realm of what you're allowed to patent. But when you start moving from laws of nature towards, let's say, a process that makes use of F equals MA, like just about any mechanical device, I would probably say any mechanical device you could say makes use of that law of nature, where do you draw the line? And currently, you know, there's been all kinds of legal tests the law has attempted to use. Currently in the U.S., the law says there's a difference between patenting a law of nature or an abstract idea on the one hand, which you can't patent. That's excluded. And what you can patent is a practical application of the abstract idea. So F equals MA, you can't patent, but a mousetrap, you can patent. That's a practical application of that law of nature. But there's all kinds of things in the continuum in between that make it very hard to draw the line between an abstract idea and a practical application of the abstract idea. And the way it plays out is in individual cases. And the courts and the patent offices around the world have come up with a bunch of guidelines and heuristics and examples that we all as patent lawyers work with, and we do our best, and it's very, very messy. But that's the way it is. And that's part of why clients come to me, because I'm familiar in the US with all of those guidelines and peculiarities of how US law and the patent office applies this distinction. And then we try to get our clients over the line from abstract idea into practical application so that they can get a patent on whatever process their software or AI carries out. Let me just get back to the transformer. You know, normally what you would patent in that context would be, let's say you come up with a new method for training a language model. That is a process that you could patent, a new method for training. And people are coming up with new tweaks or improvements in efficiency of training all the time. Those are patentable. Or on the output side, the transformer generates an output, and then you run some process to refine the output or put it into a form that's more easily usable by some other component. That could be patentable. These are all processes, more specific processes. And if they're new, they solve a problem, they do something useful that no one else has done before, then those are the kinds of algorithms or processes that you can patent.
Robert, I imagine you being in AI hell right now. I mean, and I'm kind of joking and kind of not meaning, are you spending a lot of time just trying to decipher what can be patented or not? I got to imagine you get a lot of requests. Probably some of it's just noise and you say, hey, can't be done. Then there's this whole box set of, all right, let me look into it. You got to spend a lot of the time. Now, I don't know if you like that or not. Do you spend time on that? But you learn a lot about technology and it's fun for you. Or do you say, oh, I wasted a lot of time. I'm wanting to get this impact that's over here to the right.
Yeah.
So it's almost like finding gold in all the things that come to you. Tell me how it really is.
Yeah. Well, no, you're right. I end up telling a lot of potential clients and some actual clients that what they've come up with is not patentable and we shouldn't spend the time trying to patent it. I do spend a lot of time doing that. Look, whenever something new comes out, like ChatGPT, that can serve as the foundation for spurring a huge amount of innovation, people come up with a lot of ideas for how to leverage it. Oh, I can use ChatGPT to, help me diagnose. What did I just see? Was this what OpenAI just used yesterday about a dog, something for giving advice about your dog? So a lot of those ideas might actually be useful. Some sort of custom chatbot that you can build using the GPT's feature or assistance feature they just announced yesterday, I think the vast majority of them are not going to rise to the level of being patentable. Why? Because they're probably, many of them are going to be what we'd call obvious uses of ChatGPT. Remember, I mentioned that you have to, for an invention to be patentable, it has to be non-obvious. And so this often happens when the web first came about. Everyone was coming along and saying, oh, let's take this old software we had and just implement it on the web. That didn't make it patentable all of a sudden. If it performed all of the same functions as it did on your desktop computer, but now it did it through a website, there was no new functionality in it. And so you couldn't patent it. For something to be patentable, it has to do something new or do something old in a new, better way. And so that's why I end up telling a lot of people that what they have isn't patentable, because they see large language models. They say, look, we can make a chatbot that's customized for a certain business. Well, if the way you come up with that chatbot is just putting a sort of obvious prompt on top of ChatGPT and then unleashing it on the user, that's not going to be patentable. As I said, it may actually be a very useful application, but just being useful doesn't necessarily make it patentable. Now, I don't want anyone to think I'm saying there's no way to patent any kind of new chatbot. If you come up with a chatbot that incorporates some new algorithm that really is new, useful, and non-obvious, then it might be patentable. So the devil's going to be in the details there, whether each innovation really satisfies all the requirements for patentability.
I was about to say that you have a lot of knowledge, given your history, your training in both tech, law, and even AI, as it corresponds to tech now, than the patent office does. In other words, the question is, do you find yourself debating with the patent office? Do you find yourself like trying to convince them that, hey, you guys, look at this, you're not seeing this right. Let me explain it again. And they're saying, nah, it can't be patented, Robert. Go pound sand. And you're saying, no, you need to understand better. Do you find yourself in that situation a lot?
All the time. It's one of the main sources of value I think I provide to clients is that I know how to talk to patent examiners. I know how to understand what their objections are. Very often their objections are grounded in very arcane aspects of the law and patent practice, you know, that my clients wouldn't know how to deal with on their own. And sometimes the objections are grounded in what you said. It's just that the examiners haven't grasped what the invention really is. You know, there's some other unexpected ways in which you can run into objections from patent examiners that really aren't well-founded. You know, given how rapidly AI is advancing now, for example, if I file a patent application today for something that, let's say, you and I agreed is really innovative in AI, and then by the time the examiner gets around to reviewing it, it's 2025, and he looks at it, and by then he says, you know, I've seen all kinds of stuff in recent months that's like this. This isn't that innovative, because in the examiner's mind, he's comparing it to what he's been seeing recently, which are things that were developed long after this patent application was filed, which is really when the examiner is supposed to be comparing the innovation to. But examiners are human. It's very hard to look at a patent application now and say, I need to determine whether this was patentable at the time it was filed 2 years ago, when the field has advanced so much in the last two. It's hard to remember. I mean, can we remember how you know, what limitations we were under in using large language models 12 months ago? You have to think pretty hard to remind yourself of that, because we've all gotten so used to how powerful the large language models are that are all available to us now for free. That's so where my it's head just starts as hard for spin. A patent examiner.
That's where my head starts to spin, because then it's like going back to where we started this conversation. And that's why I asked about how long does it take? You said like 5 years, and 5 years in this business, that's like light years. Everybody could be stealing that patent at that point in time now, because it could become business as usual. When they started it, this was unique. It was a methodology that nobody else had used. All of a sudden, everybody's using it. Now you got an examiner that's got to go back and say, well, do they have right to this patent or not? And now they're thinking, hey, it's business as usual.
Right. It's one reason why it can be a good idea to accelerate examination for inventions that are in a really rapidly advancing field like AI, because then the examiner is going to see the patent application only a few months after you filed it. So the examiner is more likely to look at it realistically in light of what it should be compared to. And then you're also likely to get your patent granted a lot sooner. So it's really worthwhile to consider accelerating. It does cost more money in terms of patent office filing fees, but it can often be really worth it, at least for certain selected high value inventions.
I got to believe that though, and you're also going to like certain examiners, and when you get, I don't know if you've got the same examiner before, but you're like, oh my God, I just need another examiner. Yeah, pass me on. And I honestly, it probably happens to you too. Maybe somebody comes to you and you say, you can't patent that. Ah, Robert doesn't know what the heck he's talking about. I'm going to go find another patent attorney and see if I can find somebody else to say yes. Yeah. Is that going on? I got to believe that goes on in the industry, just like anybody would take on a court case or otherwise.
Yeah, it goes on. But, you know, clients do shop around for patent attorneys. Some of them do, you know, go to someone who tells them what they want to hear. And you're right. Not very often, but there are definitely times when I or my clients want to switch examiners. Unfortunately, you cannot request a switch. The only thing you can do, you can go over their head to their boss. And then for strategic reasons, you got to think carefully about whether to do that because of the relationship. And then you can appeal. There's a board of appeals at the patent office, and you can appeal if you're really dissatisfied with what you're getting.
How many do you file versus how many get accepted?
We have a certain selection bias, I'd say, because we tend to advise clients not to file patent applications that we think don't have a high likelihood of success. And we actually think that that's best for the client, you know, because a patent is a large investment of money and time and effort. Mm-hmm. And so we don't think it's worthwhile submitting a patent application that doesn't have a really good chance of being granted, particularly given the variability among patent examiners that's outside of your control. There's so many risks that are outside of your control to start with. Why add on to that just filing a patent application on an invention that's not a very strong candidate for patenting? So for that reason, we tend to get a lot of our patents granted. But I think a lot of it's because we tend to select patents that already have that sense. Likelihood.
So you're almost 100% is what you're telling me.
We're very high. I'm not saying it's that good. Sometimes we have clients that, you know, run out of money, go out of business, and that's often a reason for them abandoning a patent application before it's granted, unfortunately.
I'm sure I'm going to ask this question that you can't answer. I'm good at that too, because I think every patent would be different. But what does a traditional and average a patent cost? Can you say? Can you give expectations?
Yeah. I'll say that for software patents tend to be more expensive than I'll call a mousetrap patent, a traditional consumer mechanical product, for a variety of reasons. I don't want to say necessarily that software is more complex, but software tends to be more abstract, which also means we try to write software patent applications in a way that makes them cover as many different variations on the invention as possible. You know, even a simple software application, if it can be implemented on a, let's say, client server, there might be lots of different components you want to describe independently and in combination with each other, which can make a software patent application more complex to design and to execute. But for, you know, getting up to the point of filing a software patent application, including doing the research up front, and all of the drafting and the patent office filing fees, can be in the range of $15,000 to $20,000. And then after that, you tend to get rejected 1, 2, 3 times for various reasons, which is a whole other conversation. If you're wondering why would you tend to get rejected several times at the patent office, but you tend to get rejected. And then if the patent is granted in the end, you may be spending another $10,000 to $15,000. So, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 from start to finish is a good number to have in mind for obtaining a patent in the U.S.
I presume that if you pay a little more, you get a little less rejection. I mean, I got to believe, if you could skip the line, surely you could influence a little bit too.
Well, there are statistics showing, and no one can say exactly why, that under the various acceleration programs at the patent office, there tends to be a higher allowance rate, which is exactly what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. That's what I figured.
Well, you might be suspecting one thing. I have other more innocent explanations. One of them is just that, as I said, the examiner is going to see something before it seems old. The other is that if you have two rejections, imagine the examiner sees your application, rejects it. We respond a month later. The examiner sees it again a month after that. It's fresh in the examiner's mind. They're more likely to do a good job examining it the second time around than under the slow process. They reject it, you respond, and then it doesn't land on their desk for another 9 months, in which case they pick it up. And sometimes I think, from their point of view, it's as if they've never seen this patent application before. And they're examining it almost all over from the start. And that's not a particularly efficient process. It can lead to more rejections.
And you've got to do an appeal for every one of those typically, if they get rejected?
We do very few appeals. We tend to be able to get patent applications through and granted without having to appeal over the examiner's head. To the very beginning, you know, talking about your daughter, people going into law, we do our best to work, I would say, in an amicable way with patent examiners, which is a very different thing than people would think of lawyers as being adversarial. You know, we often find that it's best, you know, you catch more, you catch more flies with sugar?
With honey.
Yeah, with honey. So it's best to work collaboratively to the extent possible with the examiner, while, of course, from my perspective, completely representing and advocating for my client's best interest. And that is a certain set of skills, you know, that takes a while to develop. But for anyone thinking of going into law, there's a lot of fields of law where you actually do best by learning to work in a more collaborative way with each other, which is different from, I think, the popular impression of lawyers as always fighting or being adversarial.
Is there anything on the AI front that I didn't ask or you think is worthy of stating before we kind of wrap?
I would say that because the latest generation of AI tools can be used by individuals and companies that don't have deep expertise in AI, you know, any individual or company should be thinking about how they can leverage AI and use it to boost their own skills, productivity, effectiveness, or in a business, improve their internal or external business processes. It's the ability to do those things is no longer limited to tech companies or companies that have deep expertise in the technology. And that's really, I was about to say game changing. I hate that term because people overuse it, but it's eye opening, I'd say. And I would encourage any individual team leader, I don't care what level of the organization you're at, executive, business owner, to look into what ways they can make use of this latest generation of more democratized AI that's much more user-friendly to improve how they get their work done and how they do business. When I wrote the book, for example, in 2009, all the things I wrote about for how to leverage AI, you know, they required people to be engineers, scientists, understand optimization processes and fitness functions and objective functions and be programmers or things like that. And that is increasingly not the case anymore. So that's probably the one big thing I would mention that we haven't talked about yet. It is democratizing the use of AI beyond the technical folks. And that I think is very exciting and empowering.
First of all, it sounds like you're bought in. You can see AI in a unique way. I'm on the invention side, the selling side, I'm doing use cases, et cetera, but you get to see all the patents come in a different area. And it's good to get a different view outside in, because I would say it's an opportunity of a lifetime. But like when you wrote that book in 2009, we were kind of saying that as well. We were just a little early. And I think people have kind of gotten a little bit, yeah, sure. We've already heard this kind of before. Remember, IBM did Watson. We did Jeopardy on Watson. We did a whole bunch of different stuff. But you're right. It's become democratized in the sense that the way I explain it is ChatGPT inspired interest. Kudos to them for doing so. It was built off a large language model. Now, IBM has had large language models for, you know, probably 4 or 5 years. However, the bigger concept is the foundation model with the transformer we talked about, where you can take unlabeled data and drive generative AI. So like what you were saying earlier, before it was very manual. You had to use what we call supervised learning, requires intense labeling. Now it's self-supervised via this transformer and this neural network you can create essentially on the fly. It takes a lot of GPUs, a lot mm-hmm. of power, as you know, but requires little labeling. So once you get that, you've got a model and it'll predict the next word. And it's amazing because then, you know, we talk about it's generative AI. We often associate it with language today because that's how we think and stories, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But a language could be almost anything. It's programming language. Mm-hmm. It's DNA is a language. I mean, everything is a language. So all mm-hmm. of a sudden you change the game. So I think change the game does apply here. And I do think it's going to be an opportunity of a lifetime. I think you were ahead of the game in 2009. That's fantastic. But does that book, by the way, still apply? If you go look at it right now, are you going to rewrite it?
Well, so I am working on another book, as yet untitled, planning for it to come out in just a few months, targeting February of 2024. But I think all of the general principles of the book still apply. The reason I called it The Genie in the Machine was throughout the book, I used the metaphor of a computer with AI technology as a kind of genie that you could command using high-level instructions, which was the wish, where you specified the problem you wanted to solve or the result you wanted to achieve without specifying the details. And then the AI system would, through some process, and I described a bunch of them, create an output that solved the problem or satisfied the requirements that you put into the wish. So, you know, that general process and all of its implications for invention, for what skills inventors need in order to become more effective, for how innovative companies can leverage AI to become more innovative, all of that is still applicable. It's just a different set of technologies now than it was then. And I was very careful at the time in the book to say, although most of the examples I was using back then were for evolutionary and genetic algorithms, to say, you know, the principles are not limited to that. And the technology of the moment tends to change over time. At that time, neural networks were on the out. You know, people really looked down on them. And because, you know, the algorithms hadn't gotten to where they needed to be, and the processing power wasn't where they needed to be. But, you know, here we are now, where neural networks are on the rise. Who knows what the dominant technology is going to be in a few years. Let me just say, I even steered clear. You know, you said we've kind of been here before, and as a result, people are sometimes skeptical. I think that's really valid skepticism to have. There have just been waves of AI. In the book, I avoided the use of the term AI for the most part, because there had been so many waves of promises made about how AI was going to solve everything over the decades. You know, we went through a few what were called AI winters, that I was concerned that if I was touting AI and used the term AI, people would write me off. And that may happen again, too. It could be in 6 months. It could be in 3 years. Who knows when, right? Things come in waves. But I agree with you. No matter what, if that happens again, it'll probably be because things are overpromised, not because what we're seeing now is not a really true, a transformative period of time. I think it is. It is. And it's also, you know, not everything. And so we need to be careful not to overpromise to people. And that's really hard to do when you see something that is such an incredible advance. It's both hard to not overpromise. It's hard, right? And it's hard to not get to not lead people to believe that something can do everything, even if it's not what you're saying to them. And it's also hard to simultaneously hold in your mind, this is a groundbreaking, revolutionary set of technologies, maybe on the order of the printing press, you know, or for writing or generating written content. And it has a whole range of serious limitations and things it can't do, and it can still be improved by an incredible amount. Those two ideas seem like they're opposed, and yet I think they're both true. And it's hard to hold them in your mind at the same time.
I think it's hard not to overhype, and I think we did overhype like 10 years ago. It was hard not to do it then too. I mean, we were talking about, you know, curing cancer, you know, different things like that. And because you didn't cure cancer, somehow it's a failing, which you could make the argument that it's kind of lived up to most of what it's been able to do. And now it's accelerating in exponential form. So one thing I would say on what you said earlier, though, is I get your point on not wanting to call it AI. At IBM, we're very careful, and I think we're taking the right approach. We call it augmented intelligence, not artificial intelligence, because I do think it's going to go hand in hand, at least for many years, as far as I can see. We're not near the cyborg, but, you know, I'll be long dead before that happens. But point is it will make our lives better. So if you're a leader or your business, you absolutely have to be looking at AI right now, or you're going to get behind. Right. So where can folks reach you?
Yeah. I post very frequently on LinkedIn. You can check me out there. Give me a follow, linkedin.com/in/Robert Plotkin. You can also go to my law firm's website, blueshiftip.com. I think compared to most firms, we have a ton of free content, blogs, podcasts, recorded webinars, and those are for the most part targeted at non-lawyers, therefore clients, potential clients, business owners, engineers. So they explain not just legal concepts, but legal strategies, how patents can benefit you, why you might want to obtain patents, and how they can advance your business goals. So please check all of that out. And we post new stuff frequently. I'm constantly giving webinars. I've got some coming up on patent monetization, on patenting AI technology, not surprisingly. So that's the best way to stay on top of what I and my firm are doing.
Look, I don't know that I know of any other law firm that is as social as you guys are. And I think that's a differentiator right off the top. And it's very, to your point, I've read several of the articles and understandable where it's written for everybody to have a look. So kudos to you on that. What do most entrepreneurs that are coming to you not understand about IP law? What's the biggest misconception about IP law?
The biggest one is that they think it is not possible to obtain patents on software. In fact, those are the people who don't come to us. You know, people I meet when I'm networking or socially, they say, oh, I was told or I thought that you couldn't obtain a patent on software, that the only intellectual property protection you can get is a copyright protection or trade secret protection. Somehow that idea is out there. If you go to our website, you'll see that our name is Blue Shift IP and our tagline is software patent experts. It's all we do is obtain software patents. So it is possible and it's beneficial to the companies that it's suitable for. That's absolutely the biggest impression. I would say the second one is that software patents don't provide benefits to small companies. There's an idea that only the giants of the tech world benefit from obtaining software patents. Or actually, if you're a small company and you can obtain patents on your software, it's one of the few and most cost-effective ways you can protect yourself against larger companies that have much more significant resources than you do. If you're a small company, you come up with an innovative feature, ask yourself, you know, what's your moat? What is going to stop a bigger company from seeing your product, saying that looks good, and come incorporating the key features of it into their product if you don't have patent protection? There are some other answers to that. You know, there are ways to do it, but a patent can be a really, really powerful arrow in your quiver. And that's a really serious and unfortunate misunderstanding a lot of entrepreneurs, particularly at small companies, have.
I heard you're a podcaster. You used to have a podcast. Is that true?
I did have a podcast for several years, also on technology, but a different topic, is called Technology for Mindfulness. The archive and the website are still up at technologyformindfulness.com. Originally, it was motivated by my own desire to resist and find ways to stay focused in the face of increasing technological distraction. This was back in around
2000. I'm going to have a look. I got to tell you. Keep going.
2013, 2014 or so. As a lawyer, I was finding, you know, it was harder and harder for me to just get my focused work done. How could I do that in the face of text messages? I don't have to list everything that was coming to the fore at that time. And so I did that. I also had a long background in martial arts. I started to become a meditator. And so the podcast and website brought together technology, meditation, psychology, and gave a wide variety of practical tips for how to stay focused and deal with all of the temptations and distractions that come from technology and how to lead a more balanced technological life.
I'm gonna have to check it out. We could all use that. I got to continue to reinvent myself. It's difficult, right? With, you know, you're interrupted, nonstop. All right, last question: what does a tech lawyer do for fun?
I play music. That's one. I've played piano since.
So you're a musician too? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I play piano since I was a kid. Oh. for the last, I think it's up to 5 years now, I always tinkered with blues music, and I always really wanted to dig into that deeply and really learn how to play blues. So I found someone who teaches remotely halfway across the country. I take Zoom lessons from him because I had played piano for decades on my own. Yeah. And I'm learning still from someone who teaches blues, boogie, gospel, all of those different styles of piano. Probably, you know, nothing passed around, written past 1950 or so, which is the music that I love. And so, you know, I play that myself and with others.
Wait a second. The music that you love is nothing past 1950.
That I play on piano and that I'm learning now. No, I love all kinds of music, including lots of stuff after that.
So, but you're playing a lot of stuff right now in the 40s. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you know, old blues, ragtime, R&B, stuff that starts to verge and veer into jazz, but more in the blues genre.
Makes perfect sense. I just, a couple months ago, I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And walked through and, you know, went through all the 40s and different stuff like that. Elvis had a big thing. It was pretty cool, I have to say. Robert Plotkin, thank you very much for being on the podcast. As you can tell, given the length of time we've done it, and I appreciate so much your time, that this has been extremely valuable. We'll split it into two. So we have two areas, like the front where we were kind of setting it up, and then we'll do the back part. But this has been immensely helpful. And I hope you will reach out when your book is released. We'll just walk through the book.
Absolutely.
Maybe I can get a pre-read and then I'll have all the questions ready.
Definitely. You'll get an advanced copy for sure.
Fantastic. That's great. Thank you for being here. And podcast listeners, thank you as always. Hit us on almartintalksdata@gmail.com. We'd like to hear from you. And until next time, we'll see you on the podcast. Thank you so much. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks, Al.